In the first watch of the night, as the world silvered over with the rising of the full May moon, Shakyamuni began to look back at all the details of his experience of life. He looked further and further back, beyond even his early childhood, until he found himself surveying someone else's life as if it were his own. He was able to recall every detail of that life, and then of a life before that. Lifetime after lifetime passed before his vision in a moment. At once, too, he saw the moral and spiritual articulation in every one of those remembered lives, down to the last detail. And he saw that this knowledge was also his freedom from the whole cycle of life and death. He saw with unerring clarity how this endless process is sustained simply by the mind's ignorance of its own true nature, which is to be without any limitation whatsoever. Then in the second watch of the night, Shakyamuni's vision slipped beyond the limits of his own memory to encompass the experience of all beings everywhere. He saw how beings throughout the universe, in every realm of existence, from the denizens of hell right up to the gods of the highest heaven, reaped the consequences of their actions. He saw, in short, that existence was determined by consciousness. He saw beings borne along on a current of conditions that they constantly regenerated, but constantly modified as well. He saw that nothing is forever, whether heaven or hell, and that all these beings, whether demons, gods, or humankind, were bound upon an ever-turning wheel of their own creating, taking them from heaven to earth, and from earth back up to heaven or down to hell. He saw that these realms were all mind-created, brought into existence not by a god of rewards and vengeance, but by the desires and delusions of those who inhabited them. And he saw that they would continue thus to seek rebirth so long as they cherished an idea of themselves as bounded by their separation from other beings, so long as they failed to realize that their true nature was beginningless, endless, boundless, and open like the sky. Finally, in the third watch of the night, the fundamental implications of what he was seeing came into focus as he contemplated his experience more and more deeply, more and more broadly. What he was doing turned common meditative practice on its head. He was putting aside the traditional spiritual aims, union with the Godhead or realization of a transcendent self or release of an immortal soul or even knowledge of the Absolute. Instead, he was subjecting his immediate experience to a close but supremely dispassionate examination. His awakening was not an experience as such. There was nothing to experience and no one to experience it. His freedom was not a feeling of freedom. It was a realization of the nature of freedom and the way to freedom. Simply remaining watchful, mindful, Siddhartha dwelt with his immediate experience of his own breathing process. As he did so, he saw, as clearly as he saw the unclouded moon climbing the arching darkness of the night sky, the true nature of his body and breath. He saw how his own body belonged to the dew-fragrant earth, how his own breath belonged to the lifting breeze of the dawn. With the same open, empty-handed mindfulness, he began to review all the elements of his experience, all his mental processes, sense perceptions, feelings, emotions, thoughts that go unregarded either in mundane activity or in the attempt to transcend them through meditative concentration. Wherever he turned, there was the same vision, the same reality, the same freedom, the same peace. He saw the hidden underlying pattern of his experience, unmediated by any limiting view or interpretation or bias whatsoever. Gradually, Shakyamuni found that all fixed conceptions whatsoever of reality, of what he was doing and where he was going, were dissolving from his mind. Whatever insight he had of the nature of reality was increasingly replaced by an actual seeing of the way things are. The illusion of ego disappeared, leaving only reality in its place. Nothing permanent was there from which to view the fact of impermanence. No notion of phenomena as separate from one another could survive a vision of the interdependence of all phenomena, how they all arise and fall in dependence upon the arising and falling of other phenomena. As the moral texture of the universe became as familiar to him as the back of his hand, all distinctions of good and evil became meaningless, and he saw only the suffering of beings. Recognizing the inescapable connection between craving and suffering, both craving and suffering fell away from his mind. When Shakyamuni realized that he was free from any leaning whatsoever towards sensual desire, towards conditioned existence, or towards views and opinions of any kind, he knew that his freedom was that of a Buddha. But still he remained mindful. He allowed no such pleasure as arose in him to gain power over his mind. With the red dawn coming up, and joy on the face of the night, softly he uttered the first words of his awakening.
In the endless round of living and dying, long have I sought the builder of this house. Sorrowful is repeated birth. O house builder, you are seen. Never again shall you build a house. All your rafters are broken. Your ridgepole is shattered. The conditioned mind has gone to dissolution. I have attained the end of craving.
Over several weeks, the Buddha explored the nature and implications of his awakening. To begin with, it left him with no one to whom he might pay honor and respect and worship. Yet he found himself bowing to the tree that had sheltered him while he sat in meditation, because it is in the very nature of enlightenment to pay respect and veneration as much as it is to be wise and compassionate. Then he understood what it was that he had to honor. It was the true nature of things, the law of life, that he must worship. There would always be more to learn, even for a Buddha, and there could be no learning without respect and devotion. Wherever he looked, he worshipped the Dharma, the true nature of things, and the way to freedom. He knew that the tree under which he sat reached up to the light only because its unseen roots reached ever deeper into the darkness beneath him. He saw that the river before him was the same day after day, and yet what made it a river was that it was never the same at all, from one moment to the next. And above him, behind the clouds, even when they stretched from horizon to horizon, there was the purity, warmth, and radiance of the deep blue sky. All things spoke to him of reality, and he worshipped this truth in all things. Even when a vain and tedious Brahmin came by and condescended to engage him in conversation, the Buddha knew the joy of practicing patience and compassion. But there was another issue that occupied his reflections and meditations at this time, and that resisted any easy resolution. Thus did he ruminate.
This Dharma, which I have realized, is deep, difficult to grasp, both sublime and subtle, beyond the logic-chopping dialectic of the learned. It is useless to lay a fathomless teaching such as this before a generation that delights in sensual distractions, and whose only concern is in laying up wealth and reputation.
Even as these thoughts arose, the compassion of his heart was seen by the king of the gods, Brahma Sahampati, who appeared before the Buddha and said,
"Lord, let the Blessed One teach the law. There are beings with but little dust in their eyes who will be lost to themselves through not hearing the law. Proclaim the law, for some will understand."
Out of compassion, the Buddha surveyed the world with his eye of enlightenment and saw the differing capacities of beings, and saw that indeed some had but little dust in their eyes.
Wide open are the doors of the deathless. Let those who hear show faith.
So, where to begin his ministry? not where he was, in Magadha. The region was firmly in the grip of the religious establishment. The Brahmin priests would do their best to smother his teaching. Varanasi was the place to go. The Buddha would have gone back to his two old teachers, but they were now dead. So he turned his mind to the five followers who had left him when he gave up the path of self-mortification. And at once he knew where they would be, near Varanasi, in the deer park at Sarnath. He understood the minds of these men as clearly as he remembered, with affection as well as compassion, their hard-mouthed, sharp-nosed, narrow-eyed faces. Indeed, one of them, Kandana, had been the youngest of eight wise men who had given the Buddha to be his name, Siddhartha.
I will go to Varanasi to turn the wheel of the Dharma. In this world of the blind, I will beat the drum of the deathless.
After several days walking, he found his old friends. He was tired and dusty, dressed in patched rags, his hair and beard unkempt, unmistakably the same man they had seen crack and go soft just 3 months before. But equally unmistakably, he was not the same man at all. Because as he came nearer, the resentment faded from their hearts and the soft jibes died in their throats. What was going on? What was bringing them shuffling to their feet to welcome him and fetch him water? Were they just being taken in by the old affable assurance of the man? While he bathed his feet, they lost no time in falling to debate. Over several days, the Buddha probed for a release of faith, a flash of understanding from these hardened and skeptical veterans of the spiritual quest. He seemed to them to be driving a royal chariot and four through every spiritual and religious controversy of the age. But he appealed to their reason, he appealed to their experience, he appealed to their intuition, till at last something gave way in the mind of one of the five, Kandana, and knowledge flooded in. His eyes widened in wonder. Yes, he said. Everything that is subject to origination is subject to cessation. The others looked at one another and shook their heads, mystified. It was not as if Shakyamuni had convinced wily old Kandana simply through the exercise of logic. But there was no doubt that Kandana was onto something. Kandana knew.
Kandana knows. Kandana knows.
The news was already passing through the heavenly realms to the highest abodes of the gods, where Brahma Sahampati himself was told.
At Varanasi, in the deer park at Sarnath, a perfect one, accomplished and fully enlightened, has set rolling the wheel of the Dharma.
None amongst the gods fully understood, as did the Buddha, the significance of the event, but they felt all the 10,000 worlds of this universe shake with the weight of it. The Dharma, the law, had been taught. And gradually there arose in the other four ascetics, one by one, the same spotless, immaculate vision of the Dharma. So the community of the followers of the Buddha, the Sangha, was established. His teaching is known even today for its urbanity, and in his own time it appealed particularly to urban people, to educated people, to individuals who chose to make their own way in the world rather than just accepting their place in a village community, who were not afraid of change. It appealed to merchants who had discovered that it takes all sorts to make a world, that trade depended on tolerance, on an attitude of live and let live. At Varanasi, the Buddha converted the two men who would become his foremost disciples, Shariputra and Moggallana. Moving to Uruvela, he met a group of 30 young men with their wives on a picnic party.
One of them had no wife, and so was provided with a courtesan to consort with. But in the careless abandon of their pleasures, they did not notice this courtesan slipping away with their valuables. When they realized what had happened, they abandoned their pursuit of pleasure and went in search of the girl instead. Wandering through the wood, they came upon the Buddha sitting at the root of a tree. They asked him, "Lord, has the Blessed One seen a woman?"
"Boys, what have you to do with a woman?"
They told him of the afternoon's events, and he said,
"Tell me, which is the better course, that you should seek after a woman, or that you should seek after yourselves?
Naturally, Lord, it is better to seek after ourselves.
Then sit down, and I will teach you Dharma.
They did so, and the Buddha unfolded his teaching before them until gradually, one by one, they were all seized with the truth of what he was saying and asked to be ordained as monks. This civilized exchange was typical of many of his encounters. Nothing much would happen on the surface. In fact, in one case, that of Mahakashapa, no word was spoken on either side. And yet each of them represented a whole universe being turned inside out. In each of them, the world came to a halt, and nothing could ever be the same again. A few of his followers were already arahants, fully enlightened as he was. However, the Buddha was in Uruvela with a view to an altogether different sort of encounter. He sought a confrontation with the heart of the Brahminical tradition of animal sacrifice and caste laws. He went to visit the fire-worshipping, matted-haired ascetics led by Kashyapa of Uruvela, a respected and feared master of supernormal powers. The Buddha's way was always to argue with people on the basis of their own assumptions. In this case, the argument would have to be based on miraculous powers. He asked Kashyapa if he might spend a night in their fire chamber, guarded by a huge and venomous cobra. But when the Buddha emerged unscathed the next morning, this was not enough to persuade Kashyapa that he himself had anything to learn. The Buddha performed more obvious miracles, concluding by holding back a flood. Still, Kashyapa thought to himself, "The great monk is very mighty, but he is not an arahant like me." Finally, the Buddha said, "Kashyapa, you are not an arahant, and the way you are going, you never will become one." The game was up. The smokescreen of power lifted. Kashyapa saw in an instant that he knew nothing, and he fell on his knees and asked to receive the going forth and admission into the order. His followers, over 1,000 of them, followed him. To all these erstwhile fire worshippers, the Buddha delivered what is known as the fire sermon.
All is burning. The eye is burning. All the senses are burning. Forms are burning. All sense objects are burning. All sense contact is burning. The mind is burning. Consumed with the fire of craving, of hatred, of infatuation, of birth, aging and death, of sorrow, vexation, and despair. Seeing this, the wise disciple does not feed this fire. Whatever feeling arises, he does not set it on fire. Then his craving fades away, and his heart is liberated.
What the Buddha taught was radical and even revolutionary, particularly in its challenge to the traditions of caste and animal sacrifice, by which the religious establishment secured its authority. His teachings were regarded by many commentators as undermining the very fabric of society. The Buddha's skill in debate made him enemies, but it won him important converts. One was King Bibisara of Magadha, who gave him the bamboo grove at Rajagriha. Another of his early lay disciples was the wealthiest man of the neighboring state of Kosala, Anathapindika, who donated the celebrated Jeta Grove in Shravasti. For the remaining 45 years or so of his life, the Buddha wandered from place to place throughout the civilized world of the Ganges Basin, teaching gods and men, kings and courtesans, merchants and peasants, priests and beggars. Volume after volume of scriptures testify to the Buddha's impact on innumerable individuals who came to him with their suffering, their hope, their curiosity, their cleverness or their stupidity, their reverence or their abuse. Always they are met by the same mixture of unshakable compassion, confidence and fearlessness, together with occasionally an ironic but kindly amusement. He owed his success not just to the profundity of what he taught or the clarity with which he taught it, but perhaps primarily to his own embodiment of what he taught. His very presence inspired faith in what he taught. He was just one out of a host of other spiritual and philosophical teachers, and he was not universally popular by any means. However, the Buddha towered above his contemporaries in the extent and depth of his influence and the number of his disciples, which included the two most powerful rulers of northern India. The Buddha's day was a regular one of teaching and begging for alms, meditation and reflection on the needs of his disciples. As for his nights, in the first watch, between 6 and 10, he instructed the monks. In the second watch, between 10 and 2, he instructed the gods. And in the third watch, he walked up and down a little, or lay down, and allowed his intuitive vision to bring him news, perhaps, of what he might expect of the following day. The Buddha also had a personal attendant who had two important functions. He controlled the constant flow of visitors, and he provided companionship, friendship. It was a job that required particular qualities of devotion and sensitivity, and not all of the Buddha's companions were satisfactory. One was Sunakata, who eventually left the order and went about Vaishali denigrating the worth of the Buddha's teaching. Then there was Magiya, who is reported as insisting on going to meditate when the Buddha needed his company. Needless to say, Magiya's meditation was then vitiated by distractions, and the Buddha had to point out to him that the heart's release in meditation cannot be willed. It is a transformation of the whole being that has to be developed at all levels of experience, beginning with the quality of one's friendship. The one companion who succeeded better than anyone at being a friend to the Buddha was actually his stepbrother, Ananda. And he did this without ever being a particularly eminent disciple. He was one of a number of the Buddha's relatives who became converts, including his own son, Rahula, who joined the order, and his father, who became a lay disciple. But Ananda was the most significant of these. For one thing, he is credited with remembering every detail of the Buddha's almost daily discourses. Ananda was also instrumental in establishing the order of nuns. After the death of the Buddha's father, his stepmother, Mahaprajapati, who had cared for him as a child, came and asked to be admitted into the Sangha. The Buddha at once foresaw all sorts of problems and refused her. Relations between the sexes were difficult enough in the world, let alone in an order of wandering celibates. But she came back later, accompanied by a number of other women. They had all cut off their hair and were wearing robes, and Ananda pressed the Buddha to admit them. He agreed on certain conditions. And many would say that of all the stories of individuals making the decision to commit themselves to the Buddhist path, the most touching, and in many ways the most emblematic of the Buddhist vision, is that of a woman called Kisa Gotami. On a certain occasion, a young woman of Shravasti, called Kisa Gotami, pushed her way through a crowd of people listening to the Buddha speak. She was unkempt and wild-eyed, and she carried a child on her hip, holding his head to her shoulder. She dropped on her knees before the Buddha. "Lord, give me medicine for my child." The crowd grew silent. Many of them had already tried to tell her that her child was dead. But in her grief, Kisa Gotami's mind had turned. Some thought that the Buddha would perform a miracle. Others thought that he would at least bring her to her senses and then question her, or tell a parable of impermanence, or a story of one of his previous lives. At length, the Buddha spoke.
"I have a cure. But to effect it, you must find a mustard seed in this town. You need just one. But it must come from a household in which no one has died."
Some in the crowd thought the Buddha cruel and evasive to lead her on in this way, but Kisa Gotami departed joyfully, holding tightly to her burden of hope. At the first houses she called at, she asked first for the mustard seed, and only then if anyone had ever died in the household. As soon as they said yes, she was off. After a while, she started to forget about the mustard seed, and before long, some of the things people were saying started to infiltrate her fixated mind. "The living are few, but the dead are many," they said. She even started to notice their tears as they spoke of a parent or child they had lost. Her deluded hopes kept her going from house to house, but the more she visited, the more clearly she heard and saw the suffering and loss of others. Finally, she looked at her own child and saw that she must let him go. She went to the charnel ground and buried him, and peace flooded her heart. She went to where the Buddha was. "The mustard seed has done its work," she said. "I go for refuge to the Blessed One, to the Dharma, and to the community." In this way, Kisa Gotami joined the order of nuns. The Buddha always had to rely upon his psychological acumen. Occasionally, he had to employ it in less controlled situations. The most terrifying human being he ever faced was undoubtedly Angulimala, whose name means necklace of fingers. Angulimala was terrorizing the country around Shravasti, murdering anyone he could find in order to add to his grisly bijouterie. He was immensely strong and swift, and so cunning that whole troops of soldiers would be picked off one by one as they passed through his forested domain. One morning, after completing his arms round, the Buddha went that way himself, ignoring all warnings. As he saw the monk approaching, Angulimala felt himself seized by excitement, a lust to kill, to appease the monster of hatred that had consumed his heart. He ran towards the monk, who walked slowly, as monks do. And he drew his sword as he ran, waiting for his victim to turn and know his own death. For Angulimala loved the beauty of every different expression of terror. But the monk did not turn. And unbelievably, Angulimala was getting no closer. For the first time in his life, he knew fear. Finally, he slowed down, shouting, "Stop, monk!"
"I have stopped, Angulimala. You yourself stop."
"What do you mean, monk? You are still walking."
"I have relinquished harming any living thing, therefore I have completely stopped. You, however, are constrained to continue because you have no restraint."
At this, Angulimala's mind stopped. His world vanished. And he awoke to the truth. He threw his weapons into a pit and threw himself at the Buddha's feet and asked for the going forth. Thus Angulimala was ordained, and in time he became an arahant, fully enlightened. As he grew older, the Buddha had to make it more and more clear what he was there for. He was not a god, he was not omniscient, he was not a leader, not an authority or a power.
"All my teaching is simply about suffering and the ending of suffering."
He was often asked whether a Buddha could be said to exist or not after death. The fact, as far as he was concerned, was that he had in effect died when he became enlightened, so his apparent death, what is called the parinirvana, was simply a dropping away of the body. He had been free for 45 years anyway. Essentially, his parinirvana changed nothing. So there was no way of saying what happens to a Buddha, or anyone who becomes enlightened, after his parinirvana, whether he exists or whether he does not exist. Neither statement fits the facts. What we think of as existence or non-existence cannot apply here. One of his followers who was dying, called Vakali, asked for the Buddha to come and see him. The Buddha did so, and after they had talked, he said,
"Look, Vakali, why do you want to see this filthy body? He who sees the Dharma sees me. He who sees me sees the Dharma."
Images of the Buddha give the impression that here is a god to be worshipped, but the Buddha is clearly very much more mysterious than a god. The nature of Buddhahood is an insoluble mystery that can be known only by those members of the Sangha who partake of that same nature. In his final year, at the age of 80, at the beginning of the rainy season, which he spent in the village of Beluva, the Buddha fell sick with dysentery, and he knew he was close to death. Being unable at this time to take leave of the monks and nuns, he forcibly repressed his sickness. When he had recovered, he found that during his sickness, Ananda had reassured himself with the thought that the Buddha would not pass away without making a pronouncement about the community.
But Ananda, what does the order of monks expect of me? It is for someone who thinks, I will lead the order, or the order depends on me, to make a pronouncement about the order. For myself, my body is like a worn-out cart, held together with rope. Only when the Tathagata abides in the concentration of mind without an object, is his body at ease. Ananda, the Dharma is for you to realize, yourself. Be an island unto yourself, a refuge unto yourself and to no other. Make the Dharma your island, the Dharma and nothing else your refuge.
At this time, the Buddha's two chief disciples, Shariputra and Moggallana, both died. The Buddha also heard of the fall of his own people, the Shakyans, to the attack of Vidudava of Kosala. Vidudava had seized the throne from the Buddha's old patron, King Pasanedi, and Pasanedi had died on the way to fetch help from his nephew, Ajatasattu. The old order was passing. The Buddha roused himself for a final tour, walking painfully from place to place and making sure that the last words his followers heard from him would be the very heart and pith of his teaching. At a place called Pava, he ate a meal of truffles provided by a goldsmith called Kunda. This brought back his dysentery, and he knew that it was all over with him. Finally, he and Ananda approached Kusinara, close to his old home of Kapilavastu, and they stopped at a grove of sala trees planted in two rows, east to west, with a stone couch at one end. The Buddha sent back word that Kunda the smith should not feel in the least uneasy at what had happened, and then he lay down on his side. The sala trees, it is said, were in full flower, though it was not the season, and the blossom at once started to fall onto the body of the Buddha, while an unaccountable fragrance of incense filled the air, and on the soft breeze was a sound of sweetly singing voices. Monks were now starting to gather in the grove, and Ananda withdrew to a shelter beside the grove, where he leaned against the doorpost weeping and saying, I have so much to learn, and my teacher is going, he who is so kind. The Buddha called for Ananda.
Enough, Ananda. Do not grieve. Have I not told you that there must be parting from everything dear to us? For a long time, Ananda, you have given unstinted, cheerful service to the Tathagata. Your merit will bear fruit if you continue to exert yourself.
Then the Buddha spoke before the whole community of his appreciation of Ananda's qualities and virtues. The grove was now filling up with people, and Ananda organized them into family groups, so that there would be time for everyone to be presented to the Buddha before night fell. Amongst these reverent and tearful townspeople, Ananda spotted a wanderer, and he went to intercept him before he could start to engage the Buddha in a long philosophical discussion. But the Buddha saw him and beckoned him forward. The wanderer, who was called Subhadra, did indeed have a question.
Master Gautama, there are so many teachers, all with their many disciples. Which of them have the direct knowledge they claim, and which have not?
Enough, Subhadra. I will give you the means to work the answer out for yourself. Look upon the behavior of a teacher's disciples. Where the path of morality, meditation, and wisdom is practiced diligently, there will be arahants with direct knowledge in the world.
Subhadra was impressed by this, and he asked to join the order. Meanwhile, monks continue to arrive into the early hours of the morning to witness the parinirvana, the passing from this world, of the Buddha. Eventually, the Buddha asked the assembled order if they had any further doubts about his teaching. He encouraged them to speak up, or to get a friend to speak up in their place if they felt too nervous. In the light of many flickering lamps, the Buddha could see hundreds of different faces, young and old, tearful and composed, unenlightened and fully enlightened. Now truly, he had done what had to be done. His last words were,
"Impermanent are all compounded things. With mindfulness, strive on."